Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and this morning it's morning in Dublin, but it's not in where our guest is. We are joined by contributor and journalist and friend of the pod. Let's tell the truth here, Hannah McCarthy, who is sitting in a coffee shop in Kabul. Hannah, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me on, Tony.
It's good to see your face. I haven't seen you in a while, and you've been. You've been traveling. The last time I think we spoke, you had left Lebanon and had gone into Iraq, and you'd moved on from then, and now you are in Afghanistan, and you are on the ground covering what is actually, I think, as of yesterday, 100 days of the Taliban's rule. How are you, and how are things, first of all?
The situation at the moment, I think for a lot of people, there's still a bit of kind of disbelief at like how quickly the situation's changed. You know, you talk to people, you talk to kind of healthcare staff, you talk to business owners in Kabul. And honestly, like you have moments where you kind of talk to people and they describe the situation and they almost have this whole double take where they're like, is this real? You know, I was talking to a business owner, you know, who invested like tens of thousands in coffee shops and restaurants before August, had openings in July. And he said, you know, I wake up in the morning and I kind of think things are normal. And then I realize, no, I didn't dream this. Like, you know, the Taliban are in power. Mm. It's the same for some of the NGOs. They're like, you know, a lot of them have had contingency plannings for this. But I mean, the actual reality and now having to deal with people who, you know, the EU and the US and, you know, the rest of the West declare terrorists and having them in charge of ministries. I mean, it's a very uncertain time. And I mean, I think any kind of statements you make about the current situation, I mean, this is, everyone's kind of holding their breath, I think, for the next couple of months, as we see, you know, what the impact of the winter is, what the impact of aid cuts is, and, you know, what kind of concessions the Taliban make, in, you know, in terms of women's rights, in terms of, like, press freedom, in terms of respect for minorities.
You've just summed it up really well there in terms of the world is sitting there watching, but at the same time, the money has been cut off. The funds have been removed. I think it was this week, Pakistan pledged, was it $28 million? I mean, it's not a whole lot of money in terms of, you know, the size of a country like Afghanistan. It's $28 million in humanitarian aid. But you're facing a situation whereby state employees, your civil servants, your doctors, your nurses, they haven't been paid in nearly 4 months, you were telling me before we came on air, Hannah.
Yeah, so I was talking to someone at the UN kind of this morning, and, you know, he was saying, you know, he's never seen anything like this in modern history where overnight development aid, foreign aid is cut off to a country. And it's not just the aid that was cut off. There was the US banks held $8 billion dollars worth of Afghan government money, which they don't have access to, and which, you know, they would be using to like buy electricity, importing food. You know, we hope, obviously nothing's certain with this regime. So the kind of contraction you've seen in the economy, you know, I'm normally based in Beirut, but, you know, the Beirut economic collapse, I mean, it was more of a slow rot over 2 years. And what you've seen happen between August and now, I mean, it's, you know, the economy is going to contract 30%. And it was already, you know, a small economy that didn't really support the 40 million people who, you know, needed to make livelihoods off it. So at the moment, because of US sanctions, no money can go directly to the Taliban government. So, you know, the officials who are working at the central bank, the officials who are working at the Ministry for Health, you know, who are the same ones who were there before, are not being paid. And if you go to public hospitals at the moment, you know, there are people who for the last, you know, 4 months and some longer, you know, who are working in ICU units, neonatal units. There are midwives who are, you know, doing kind of 70, 80, 90 hours a week, traveling in from their homes, and they're not being paid. So I think what the UN has done, there is a kind of, there's kind of a group of hospitals that were basically managed by foreign NGOs. And the UN has managed to kind of pay 26,000 workers who work there. And again, there's already kind of kickback from the Taliban, I think, about the money basically not going through the ministry and going directly to the workers. And I think, again, over the next few months, there's going to be kind of a playoff with how Like there's basically very little chance that UN and NGOs will be able to get enough money into Afghanistan to compensate for the aid cuts and the sanctions.
Going to interrupt the podcast for that moment that you don't like, but we have to do. It is us asking you to support this project, the wider platform, all of the voices you hear and the stories you hear. It's been a unbelievable week, a few weeks actually. And some of the things we've done, they've really made a difference. I've been contacted by Nadim to say that, you know, we're getting more traction on his case and his leave to remain. I've gotten messages from Kira saying that she's been in contact with people in the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive, people from the government itself, and people from the opposition. Those things that we do, and we pile on and we fight for it and we try and help amplify, they matter, but they don't actually happen unless we can keep the platform viable. And at the moment, we just aren't. We haven't been, we're not. And it's more difficult for me. It's more difficult to keep this going because there's more bills and I just have no other income stream at this stage. So if you're one of the thousands of people listening every day, it just means you have to put your hands in your pocket and help us out. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It really would make all the difference. Just a couple of quid keeps the mics on, keeps us being able to talk to those people. And we'll just go from there. Please, if you can, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Let you go back to the podcast. I'm reminded of the campaign that we covered on the pod a few weeks ago about nothing kills like hunger, because you posted what I thought was a very poignant picture of people selling their domestic items like washing machines and you know, what we would consider staples of your kitchen, because they just wanted to get food. So yeah. You know, you referenced Lebanon and the issues that they had, because their economy effectively has had a slow death in many ways, and the money is dried up. But in Afghanistan, the money has been withdrawn, and yet next week, the U.S. government will resume negotiations with the Taliban. And you know, like you're on the ground in Kabul, so you know that the Taliban are making sort of gestures to the West to allow people in, to give access, to make some sort of idea that, you know, there's some sort of stability and that international finance is going to be welcomed back in. Do you get a sense that like that the actual the people of Afghanistan, they feel disempowered by this entire thing? Nothing kills like hunger, and hunger must be a real threat now.
Like absolutely. So I guess just there's a few things you kind of said there, and you know, the Taliban government, you know, they've spent 20 years fighting to be in power, and you know, they want to show that they can govern. I mean, there definitely is an interest in showing that they can manage and they can deliver, but at the moment, you know, they can't. They're cut off from the banking system. Sanctions are crippling them. They have no way of getting funds in. So at the moment, they need NGOs to be coming in. They need the UN to be coming in and delivering food to people on the ground, because without that, you know, huge numbers are going to die and are already likely to. And again, you know, in the hospital kind of units that I saw, you know, it wasn't, you know, Taliban or Pashtun community or part of the Pashtun community. But there's also Hazaras, Tajiks, Uzbeks, and, you know, every community group was represented in these hospital units and in the malnourishment units that I saw. So again, I spoke to a couple of mothers who were in the malnourishment units and some of the nurses. So, you know, they have 50 children in just one public hospital. There was 50 children there suffering from malnourishment. And you have, you know, mothers who were there who said, you know, they started getting sick 2 months ago when the sanctions kind of and the aid cuts happened. And you know, they're very nervous about bringing their children home because they know they just can't feed them. You know, I spoke to one mother who said, you know, I don't know why my child, you know, who's a year and a half, is getting sick. And I asked her what the child was feeding, and she said she was still breastfeeding the child. And then when I asked her what she herself was eating, she said, you know, my husband lost his job. I've kind of just been eating whatever we can get at that time. So, you know, she clearly wasn't being fed properly, which has a knock-on effect on all the children. And just, you know, if, you know, children are hungry, obviously you know, if you have a sustained period of malnourishment before the age of four, mm-hmm. it's not just a bout of hunger. It leaves you with a lifelong disability.
These are ACEs, as they're commonly referred to, adverse childhood experiences, and they will have lifelong experiences that will mean that they will live less fulfilled and shorter lives is what happens here. And I also want to point out that for listeners' benefits, that the NGOs have been raging against some of the sanctions that have been imposed, because they know that it's not actually hurting the regime as such as it is hurting the people on the ground. That they've been quite clear in that.
So yeah, so and I had a meeting at the UN compound in Kabul with Mary Ellen McGroarty at the weekend, who's the Irish head at the World Food Programme there. And I kind of asked her I kind of highlighted that, look, in August, 80% of Afghanistan was food insecure. But when the fighting stopped, when the Taliban took over, because you had an end to the heavy fighting and improved access around the country, you probably should have seen, a small decrease. Instead, what happened is food insecurity went up to 95%. And I mean, again, there's variables in this, but that has that extra 15%, which is about 5.5 million people, really has to be largely attributed to sanctions and the foreign aid cuts. And I asked her, if you were in a meeting with the decision makers, the people who were making this call, what would you say to them? And she said, after highlighting that obviously Afghanistan is facing the worst drought in 30 years and the effect of conflict, that these decision makers should be pragmatic about the sanctions and aid cuts they use. At the same time, the Taliban have no interest in women's rights, no interest in press freedom, and a number of them are obviously the term terrorist carries a lot of weight for different people, but I mean, would fit most countries' criteria of terrorists. So it is a tricky position that they're in. And I mean, the reality is the bargaining position they have now, they can get concessions on women's rights, on respect for minorities. The fact is that, after outcry from the international community, several deputy ministers were appointed from minority communities. Obviously, there's no women in cabinet at the moment, but at the same time, that has to be balanced with the fact that, people are in an incredibly frightening position with no security, no certainty, and the World Food Programme at the moment is severely underfunded in terms of what it needs to do over the winter.
Yeah, and I think you've just given us a really good summation of where we are, and as the international community looks on, we've kind of turned away, after the fall and after they took power, we've turned away and we don't understand what actually happens. And I'm reminded of the estimates anywhere between, half a million and a million people who they now estimate died in Iraq due to sanctions, due to things that they couldn't bring into the country, be it financial, be it medical, be it other resources. And, after a 20-year conflict, this is, we don't get to turn away, but can I ask Hannah, the man on the street or the woman who's caring and trying to feed her children, do they still feel like, I know you said at the outset that they feel it's a surreal situation that, they are now the government in effect, but do they feel that they have been totally abandoned and, let down by the West?
Well, first of all, some people are just happy that the fighting is over. But what I would say is, there's a real mixture. I mean, some people, they were struggling before. Like, there was malnourishment before. People were in a very tricky situation before. Talking to, maybe the kind of the people who make up more of the middle class, I mean, they're really torn. I was speaking to a pharmacist who, when I asked him about the sanctions, he was like, look, that's a good policy for the Taliban. They're terrible. You can't make concessions to them. But he was absolutely recognizing that, it's devastating for ordinary people. Capital controls means that his pharmacy can only take out, 10,000 Afghan a week, which is about $100. That's for salaries to restock, to pay for all those expenses. And he says, people are coming in, they just can't afford medicine, and we can't, we're not going to be able to continue much longer with those kind of controls. So, I mean, you have people, there was no election. No one has voted for the Taliban. And there are people who absolutely don't want them in power. But there's also people who, have lived through, decades of upheaval, and are just happy that at least there's not, heavy outright firing or you know, artillery strikes.
There are still pockets.
Yeah. There is still pockets of fighting, but in terms of like the kind of heavy fighting you saw before, I mean, it's not on that scale. And also just one thing to like even just note on that Iraq comparison is that Iraq had one of the best healthcare systems, you know, in the Middle East when it was hit with sanctions. And I mean, it was starting from a much stronger position than Afghanistan. Afghanistan did not have the kind of, you know, socialist style healthcare system that Iraq actually had when the West imposed sanctions. So, you know, the impact that those kind of sanctions and the immediate aid cuts that can have on Afghanistan are much more devastating and will be much more devastating much more quickly.
Yeah, so it's all the news is fairly grim. Can I ask, obviously you're there on the ground as an international journalist, how is the local journalists faring? Are they as free to move about the place as, say, someone who's come in with international credentials?
I have not seen one local journalist in any of the meetings that I've been in with ministers, any of the other press briefings. The Taliban, you know, have made a clear decision that they want foreign press on the ground covering the humanitarian issues, which are absolutely real and, you know, look set to be devastating. At the same time, that's part of a policy to get the West to concede on sanctions and aid cuts. It's not any sign that the Taliban have changed their tune about press freedom. And in terms of local press, I mean, the majority of Afghan journalists are out of work. You know, there have already been, you know, laws around, you know, the kind of ones that we have in the West around, you know, access to information. These kind of laws are already being repealed by the Taliban. And again, I spoke with a member of the Afghan Journalists Union, and they said that, you know, the local Taliban intelligence chief is always already the one who's dictating, you know, what local journalists should say. So I think, you know, the humanitarian issue has to be reported, but also I think, you know, people have to be very careful, particularly members of the foreign press, about, you know, what kind of image they're creating of the Taliban. Because this is not about press freedom. Having foreign press here is not about, you know, respect for journalism or free speech. You know, it's about, you know, putting pressure on the West to concede on sanctions and aid cuts, which are having a devastating impact.
I just want to put it into context as well, in terms of put it all into this toxic cocktail that we seem to have. Iran is in the process of sending Afghan refugees back, and the processing of Afghan refugees who fled to the US has been so unsuccessful that I think I'm right in saying something like about 150 have been processed out of about 28,000. So it really defies logic that you know that we're not all connected in this geopolitically, economically, and just in a humanitarian basis. It's a humanitarian crisis ultimately, Hannah.
Yeah, and again, you know, I spoke to someone at the UN today, and they said they have. No, this is an unprecedented crisis that you're about to see. I mean, there's 40 million people in Afghanistan, 23 million at the moment are food insecure and don't know, aren't able to put, you know, a plate of food on their table. The neighboring countries around Afghanistan are incredibly nervous about what's going to happen, you know, as the winter season actually starts. So, you know, Pakistan has seen an influx of refugees. Iran, Uzbekistan actually closed its border with Afghanistan kind of last month before the presidential elections there. So, I mean, there are countries there, you know, the last government had outstanding debts with a lot of these governments, you know, over energy bills and stuff like that. But a lot of them kind of have recognized that they don't have an alternative but to try and give some funding to Afghanistan. You know, Iran is giving, selling energy at a discounted rate to Afghanistan because, I mean, if electricity goes out, you know, if there's a blackout there, people are going to move. You know, if people have no food, no electricity, if they have no way to keep warm in absolutely freezing winters, I mean, they're going to move. Like, no one's going to stay still in those situations. Even, you know, a walk and a kind of crossing the Iranian border or trying to get into Turkey, even though that's very risky, it's better than the situation that they're facing at home.
Yeah, that's and I think the estimate I read was something like 5,000 a day trying to get into Iran alone. So, yeah. I mean, this is really, really unbelievable. Like Hannah, I'm gonna leave it there. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk to us. I hope you're staying safe. I'm I'm actually think it's great that you are voicing this in such a nuanced and broad manner, and it's really appreciated to do that. But please stay safe and mind yourself out there. It's you're halfway across the world in what is ultimately a hostile regime in charge in many regards, particularly in a feminist, through a feminist lens.
Well, super. Well, thanks very much, Tony, for having me on.
Not at all. Listen, folks, we'll be back. We're actually covering Gaza next, so we'll be back to Palestine in another follow up podcast. People can check, can follow Hannah on her Instagram and on Twitter. I'll post the links there. She's putting up daily, almost picture based narratives, and I would say to you, some of them are very poignant. So do have a look. Check it out. Talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony.